down there in South Carolina, and you put out multiple kilowatts of signal at 400 megacycles, and you run a strip chart recorder, and you look at all the statistics of that propagating path, and you come up with a bunch of charts and graphs as to what over-the-horizon propagation is like and what kind of reliability. Because those guys were not like that movie called Contact, where the radio astronomer, Ali was her name, I can't think of her name right now, where she was listening with earphones to a radio telescope receiver, and she knew what something funny was going on. These guys are running a strip chart recorder, not listening to it. Therefore, a fair amount of that data they've got. A fair amount of that data has aircraft reflection, and they don't know it. And therefore, the real propagation is a different set of numbers. Until a ham radio operator really listening with earphones listens to a long-range signal over the horizon, you'd never know that, if you know what I mean. All right, anybody else have any further questions or comments on all of the above so far? Give me a call, Dennis, right now, K2LIW and the Tech Man.
A comment again to Leo.
Rich recognized, and will it be anybody else?
Ooh, VBN.
Mr. VBN, okay. Maybe he's the guy I heard one letter, I heard one letter coming through before, just the N. And so, Rich first, N2EO, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, apropos to what you said about myself and Barry used to keep a sked with K3PGP in Pittsburgh on 432. We had the same experience as you. Every few minutes, we didn't actually time it. Signals would peak up and then go back down. We attributed it also to aircraft going east to west or west to east. But we could work K3PGP in Pittsburgh just about every night. He had a dish. And Barry was using two Yagis on 432. I was using one.
Yeah, it turns out that radio gets there in ways you'd never believe. During those QSOs, I had, from my automobile, a 2-meter sideband going up to Rome, New York. There was a guy in southern New Jersey, keep forgetting his call letters. He was 200 miles away from me. And so I'm running 180 watts of sideband from my car. He's running a full gallon of sideband with four Yagis down there in southern New Jersey. But how in the world did that signal go 200 miles over the Adirondack Mountains, over the Catskill Mountains, through the trees and everything else, and get to my simple little antenna, mag mount antenna, on the top of the station wagon, down in the troughs of the New York State Thruway? How in the world did that signal get there? And we were getting 90% copy. So, the signal was being so scattered through so much, sifted through so much hardware, that there was no longer any polarization left. Even though he's transmitting pure horizontal, my 5/8 wave vertical whip, or the horizontal, can't think of the brand name of the Don antenna now, the horizontal antenna, they sounded the same. Mr. VBN, go right ahead, sir, with your question or comment. K2LIW in the Tech Net.
This is KB2VBN, Far Rockaway. I've been having trouble with my antenna. Right now, I'm using a magnetic mount antenna on a top piece of sheet metal on top of the grass. It's sitting on top of the grass. Am I making the repeater okay?
An antenna on top of the grass. Yes. A tiny bit of noise in the background, but you're doing quite well tonight, Fred. So what in the world made you decide to put the antenna on top of the grass instead of on top of the chimney of the house? KB2VBN, Far Rockaway, far out with an antenna. K2RIW, you got it, Fred.
Yeah, the landlord, he don't want the antenna on the roof. He has an alarm up there. I had it on my windowsill. It doesn't work no more. Every time I put it on the windowsill, I'm on ground level, on beach level. the SWR goes every time. So the only way I can get the SWR down to make the transmission is put it on a sheet metal on top of the grass. My SWR is flat. I wonder if I can do the same thing with my 80 meter antenna to make a HF transmission.
Yeah, funny you should ask, Fred. Stand by a second. If you take a look at the September issue of QST Magazine, the lead article in Joel, the Doctor Is In section, talks about taking a either a 43-foot high or a 64-foot high 80-meter vertical antenna and using it on 160. And the article does a very nice job of telling you what will happen, what is required to re-impedance match the antenna. And I've started a series of letters back and forth between me and Joel on that exact subject, because what it's based on is two things. One, that beautiful antenna that, my goodness, why can't I think of the guy's call letters? I know him so darn well. Mel, K2KEY, is who I'm trying to think of, because he's a silent key for a couple of years now. I'm forgetting him. Mel had this simple piece of wire, green-colored insulated wire hanging from his evergreen tree out in front of his house as a pure vertical antenna piece of wire, and it worked like a charm. And everybody thinks that a vertical antenna has got to be fed as a quarter-wave device. You can make it a half-wave long. You don't have to feed it in the center. You can feed it at the bottom, is at the outer edge of the dipole. When you do that, yes, you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance. And if you start shrinking down the antenna, like the article in the lead issue of September, in Doctor Is In, September issue 2014, you'll see that you can re-resonate the antenna, even though it's too small, by putting in the loading coil and top hat capacitors and so on. But let me drop. My point with Joel is that if you make the antenna not a quarter wavelength long, electronically, mechanically, I'm not telling you to make it longer mechanically. If you've only got 64 feet of wire, use it, and which is much too short for 160 meters. But if you put the right kind of a loading coil in the right place, you can re-resonate it as a quarter-wave resonator or as a half-wave resonator. As a half-wave resonator, by putting the loading coil in the center and feeding it at the bottom, you're feeding probably a 10 or 20,000 ohm impedance. Takes an L network to step it up, because it might run out of range of your antenna tuner, unless you have just the right length of coax to it. Every antenna tuner, by the way, there's a certain map you could make of the Smith chart as to what portion of the Smith chart it can thoroughly cover, and other parts it can't. And by choosing the right length of transmission line, you rotate your signal into the right part of the Smith chart, and all of a sudden your antenna tuner will pick it up. Let me drop it. But when you make the resonator a half wavelength long electronically by a center loading coil and or top hat capacitors, your choice, and you feed it from the bottom, feed it from the outer edge, you're feeding a very high impedance. But when you do that, you don't need a zillion ground plane radials. One simple stake in the ground is enough. As such, as a temporary or permanent antenna, but as a temporary antenna during a field day operation, this thing's got a lot to go for it. Joel has started modeling that antenna, and we're now starting to discover, it's my opinion that Joel's starting to discover, that the current modeling programs are not really designed for that kind of an antenna. They can't quite handle it. Very similar to many of the antennas that I have patented with reference to radio frequency identification readers, these compact antennas that I've worked on the design of for the last 10 years, many of those antennas that are working like a charm. I'm talking about 1.05 standing wave ratio all the way across the 3% bandwidth from 902 to 928 megacycles. These kind of exotic antennas made out of sheet metal, they're only a few inches long, if you know what I mean. But because the sheet metal is so wide, the currently available modeling programs cannot handle that. It doesn't predict the performance that we're really getting. And I think Joel is running into a similar problem. And I'm about to send him some more email on that exact subject. I think his modeling program is no longer handling it. We've had now two or three very progressive guys. Let me drop them. First of all, Mel, K2KEY, with his simple piece of vertical wire. We've also had a number of guys who have fed half-wavelength ground plane-like antennas from the balcony of their 10 or 20-story high apartment building, where the radiator was a helically wound thing about 16 feet long, and they set it up to be electronically a half-wavelength long and fed it from the bottom, and their antenna tuner had enough range to do that with the right length of transmission line, using as a counterpoise nothing but the metal safety railing on the balcony. No ground plane radios at all. And the antenna worked like a charm. So there's a whole lot of advantage in going to a half-wave resonator and feeding it from the bottom end. You have to do some unusual things with impedance matching, but a whole lot of ground plane radials are not required, and the antenna doesn't have to have the full length if you're smart enough to force it into resonance by way of loading coils and top hat capacitors, and if you choose half-wave resonance. It's a whole class of antennas that have been not covered at all that I can find out in the good books, and the few guys who go there and build an antenna like this say, wow, this thing works like a charm. How come I don't read any articles on this? So there's a whole class of antennas along these lines that somebody's got to write an article on now, Fred. And so I know you could do it from your sheet of metal or your grounding rod in Far Rockaway with the right kind of antenna connected to it. Could do it in ways that don't require a zillion ground plane radials. Because if I am guessing if you're at all like me, you're not looking forward to laying down 32 ground plane radials all 67 feet long. KB2, VBN, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Fred.
Hey, Roger. Yeah, I'm going to try and see if I can get on 80 meters and see if I could be heard. I haven't did it yet. I haven't made a shout out yet, or 80 or 10 meters. I got to break the rig. I got to bring it out and put it together and see if it'll work with the antenna.
Now, what I'm telling you about this exotic, slightly new antenna, or you could call it a very old antenna, but we're resurrecting it, so to speak, you're not going to be able to do that tomorrow morning. There's some details we've got to iron out in this one. For the time being, my recommendation is you put up a simple 80-meter half-wave dipole. That's 132 feet of 16-gauge wire set in the center with your coax cable and a few turns of the coax cable acting as an RF choke right at the antenna. And even if you can't mount it very high, even if you have to slant it from the tree in your front yard to the ground in the backyard, so to speak, a sloper-type dipole, do you think there's one way or another you can put up either 132 feet of wire, and the wire doesn't have to all be out flat, doesn't have to be parallel to the ground, you can zigzag it up and down, left and right. Could you feed a real half-wave dipole somewhere onto your property? And don't worry about the altitude. It'll at least get you on the air. Are you able to do that, Fred? KB2VBN, K2LIW.
Roger, I can do that as long as I camouflage it to this real thin copper wire.
Yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard to top the very simple performance of a half-wave dipole. And there's ways of shrinking it down with loading coils and top hat capacitors, but start off with a half-wave dipole. That gets you on the air, gets you talking to people. And then these other antennas that are a little bit more exotic than I'm telling you about is something to tuck away into the back of your brain. You're going to be building at a later time when Joel and I iron out some of the details on this, if you know what I mean. I know there's another kind of antenna there, and the fact that we're running into some problems with the conventionally available computer modeling programs can't quite handle this. When you take an antenna that has been shrunk down in size, let's talk about a half-wave dipole, and there's something very funny taking place here. You take a half-wave dipole and you shrink it down to half the size. Instead of being 132 feet long, you make it 60 feet long or 40 feet long. And you look at the impedance of that. It's probably got 5,000 ohms of capacitive reactance and a resistive component that's 15 ohms. That's a very difficult impedance to match. With a very broadband antenna tuner, you can match that. As long as you can force your trunk of wire into electronic resonance at your frequency, it will radiate like a charm. Let me drop. But here's the peculiarity that I've been discovering that's not very well known. If you're just talking about the reactive component, you put in the right kind of a loading coil and you take out the reactive component. That's easy. The resistive component starts getting very low. You start making the antenna short, and the 72 ohm resistive impedance starts going down to very small number of ohms pretty fast when it's fed in the center. When you feed it out at the outer edge, where when it's a full half-wave dipole, it would have been something like 1,500 ohms, now the output, the impedance at the outer edge becomes a very high number of ohms when you shrink the antenna down and force it into resonance with the loading coil in the center. Opposite of common sense. So when you're feeding in the center, the resistive component goes down. When you're feeding it at the outer edge, the resistive component goes up, and it might hit numbers like 10 or 20,000 ohms, and that'll scare you at first. You go to the Berkeley program, you just Google the word impedance match and Berkeley, and you'll come up with a computer program where you plug in the impedance of your antenna, and you plug in the impedance of your transmitter, which of course is going to be 50 ohms, and you plug in the frequency, which maybe is going to be 1.85 megacycles if you're on 160, or maybe it's going to be 8.75 megacycles if you're on 80 meters. You plug in those three pieces of data, and you press go, and it gives you 16 solutions, and you choose the one you like. And most likely you're going to choose a simple L network, one simple inductor, one simple capacitor, and the junction between the two, you feed that to the outer tip of the dipole of the antenna, that gives you the high impedance. And across the two, you feed your 50-ohm transmission line. So a very simple network will step up the impedance from your 50-ohm transmitter to 50,000 ohms if that's what you want. Don't let that scare you. And what little bit is left over, your antenna tuner can handle it. That's a whole class of antennas that people have been scared of in the past.
Repeater, time out.
People have been scared of those in the past. The advantage of doing that is that now a simple stake in the ground is your counterpoise, and it'll give you 90% efficiency. You don't need 32 ground plane radials when you feed the outer tip of a half-wavelength antenna, electronically half-wave. It's an idea that's kind of radical sounding. It's not very well covered in any of the books. Therefore, people don't believe it at first. There's a huge educational problem required here. I'm going to remind you guys that I've got to leave at 10 o'clock to go pick up somebody at the airport, so John and others will be taking over at that time. Anybody who wants any further comments and all of the above that you've heard so far, give me a call that has a name right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, now's a good a time as any to go over to the mailbag. And I hope that that lady... Ready? Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, before you go to the mailbag, you're going to go to me for a second. I have a question. Right? I have this desire to create, say, on 2 meters or 432, a dipole that's vertical. And basically, the concept is take two quarter-wave antennas and put an insulator in between the two of them and feed it from the center point. My question is, how should I calculate the antenna? Should I take that spacing or that piece of plexiglass or flex stand that I'm going to use in between the two antennas? Should I use the distance, let's say it's just an inch or 2 inches apart? Should the halfway be from end to end, or should I just consider it to be two quarter-wave antennas and not give any consideration to the space in between that holds K2RIW, K2RIW?
Yeah, that space is really there. The real electronic length is the tip-to-tip spacing, as I see it, Eric. And so even though that insulator in the center has got the bridging of your coax cable, your balun, or whatever, it still is part of the electrical length of a half-wavelength antenna. And should I review with you the so-called Brown and Woodward curve, by which you could predict the exact impedance of your antenna, whether it be quarter wavelength long, half wavelength long, no matter what frequency, no matter what diameter of the radiator itself. The so-called Brown and Woodward curves will tell you the exact impedance you're going to get ahead of time. And what's unique about the Brown and Woodward curves is it's real measured data. These two guys, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, spent close to a man year of their life, in my opinion, in roughly 1945, taking every reasonable diameter and length of radiator, whether it be wire, rod, or whatever, on any frequency you want, and measuring the real impedance. And in those days, they didn't have a vector network analyzer. Let me drop it. They had to do it the hard way with a slotted line and a slide rule. They went through all that work, plotted all that data. But what's unique about that data is it's real measured data. You'd be amazed how many seasoned antenna engineers who fall into the trap of looking up somebody's reference manual of a so-called dipole predicting equation. You plug into this equation the diameter and the length of the wire and how it zigzags, and the equation supposedly tells you the impedance of your dipole, monopole, or whatever. That equation is a curve-fitting equation for some of that graph of the Brown and Woodward curve. But that thing is not very accurate. You'd be amazed how many people will assume that that very exotic-looking equation is traceable to the Bureau and it's somebody's derivation. It's a cubic spline, curve-fitting equation, approximation. Why the hell would anybody want to use the approximation? Just because it's an equation you can easily plug into your computer program and you think it's giving you the right answer, when the real data is on those graphs of the Brown and Woodward curve. You can fall into a trap. And so what I'm getting at is, bear in mind, as Ken, the VA5VJB, who has run the antenna measuring contest for the Central States VHF Society, among other organizations, for the last 20 solid years, he has seen some antennas with guys with PhD degrees. Let me drop. PhD degrees, very exotic derivations of antennas, and they build a working model, and they measure it on his antenna range, and they find out, they end up very humble. I mean, particularly when it comes to circular polarized helical-like antennas. Boy, some of them, from the modeling equations and the real measurement in the real world. I mean, you can build an antenna that you think it's got 16 dB of gain, and you think it's going to be circularly polarized, and you end up with 4.5 dB of gain, and it's almost linear. and high vis world to boot. So the real world of antennas at times is quite different, and so you've got to be careful with the antenna modeling programs. Some of them are very good in certain areas for certain classes of antennas, but until you've made the real confirmation measurement, I mean, there was a beautiful IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society meeting I went to three quarters of a year ago, in which a very nice presentation was made from a very learned man with using very fancy computer programs. And when he got asked, did anybody actually ever build one of these and confirm it? No, why should we have to do that? Because the computer program has led you down a blind alley, if you know what I mean. So it's the outer dimensions that do it. And when it comes to making an antenna work on more than one frequency, very doable if you know what you're doing, Eric. And so to predict the impedance ahead of time by way of the Brown and Woodward curve, you can do that and find out whether or not that's within the range of your antenna tuner or within the range of the antenna impedance matching technique that you want to use. I know I've gone way off to one side of what your original question was, but maybe that's helpful. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, K2RIW, K2J. By the way, there's somebody transmitting without PL. It's trying to buzz me. But they're not succeeding. That's what I figured. But I thought I'd ask the master. This is going to be an interesting project you're going to put them together. And it's going to be at 2 meters and 432, so they're not going to be all that big. But what I will do when I put it together is I will use the VNA that I have to try and trim it and get as close to 50 ohms as possible at the frequency that I'm interested in. And these antennas really are basically going to be for, at least they're going to be tuned to one very specific frequency. I don't really care if there's much bandwidth in it or not. And I give you a moment to just imagine what I would use four of those dipoles for. And I'm sure you've already come up with the answer. But anyway, I'm making it in a way so that the whole assembly, now the other thing is I've got to test out the PVC pipe that I'm going to use, because I want it so that the antennas don't wiggle. In some of my exploration and the process that I'm trying to create here, the wiggling of the antennas adds another variable that I really would rather not have, and I think my solution is to put the dipoles inside a piece of PVC tubing and use the PVC tubing as a mount and so on and so forth. And you can take one good guess and I'm sure you'll figure it out. K2RIW, K2J.
When it comes to stopping the wiggle of an antenna, Eric, and keeping it low in wind resistance, if that was what you might want to do, don't negate the idea of guying it. And the guy wire could be nothing more than lacing cord. Lacing cord from the tip of the antenna in three or four directions down to some other structure will stop all of the wiggling of an antenna in the wind that's on top of your tower, if you know what I mean. So don't forget about guy wires. I really like guy wires. Now, when it comes to that center insulator, that's 2 inches, we'll say, I'm going to give you a visualization that will help you understand why its length doesn't matter. You know that almost every antenna you and I build is a standing wave structure. That really means there's a kind of a flywheel going on. There's a lot of stored energy. You and I, with our transmission line, we pump energy into the antenna, and we assume that the antenna is just going to jump into space. That antenna is going, the energy you put into the antenna is going to bounce back and forth 20 times before it finally gets radiated. And what you and I call resonance is choosing the right length so that all those bounces stay coherent with each other, co-phase with each other. You know that the energy is going to bounce from the right-hand tip of the antenna through your insulator toward the left-hand tip. The energy has to bounce back and forth 10 or 20 times before it gets radiated. It's got to go through that center insulator and whatever is feeding the two halves of the dipole at that point, be it your balun, your coax, or whatever. The energy is flowing through that 2 inches of space. That 2 inch of space is there. It's giving you the normal delay of the speed of light, if you know what I mean. So it is part of your antenna. I wonder if that picture I'm trying to draw mentally of the energy bouncing back and forth through your insulator makes some sense, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2EJ. Yes. No, I mean, that was my visualization to begin with, and somebody had said something different, and I didn't agree with them. So, guy wires are fine if you're putting something on the top of a tower that's not moving. I'm talking about putting this assembly on something that's moving, so, and not moving consistently. And if you put four or eight of them in a circle, you'll get the idea.
Agreed. And the structure you're going to mount them on has other dimensions. You can, you could put a lacing cord in between the tips of all the antennas, and then lacing cord from the tip of each antenna off to some other location that can stop the wiggle. Simple lacing cord. I know it's a little hokey looking, and maybe to make it look better you're going to paint it black, if you know what I mean, so it's not so hokey looking. But still, insulated guy wire, and it's not wire, it's going to be an insulated material, can, properly done, stop all wiggle if that's what you want to do. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, it's the PVC tubing serves more than one purpose. If the antennas are spaced a quarter wave apart, and it's in a circle, and you use T's like you would in plumbing, and you have cross members connected to a quad, you then have one single mounting point, in which you can keep your whole assembly from wiggling back and forth. The other reason for dipoles, as opposed to a metal plate, which is your artificial ground plane, and quarter wave antennas, is you don't need it, especially if it's being put on something that isn't metal. Like fiberglass, excellent approach. Yes, I'm a big believer in thoroughly balanced antennas. In other words, antennas that do not require a counterpoise. The quarter wave antenna requires a great big counterpoise. Just to go back now, assume I got a dipole in free space. At one instant of time, the right-hand side is positive, left-hand side is negative. There's a neutral plane down the center. I can put a sheet of metal down the middle of your dipole, normal to the dipole, at right angles to it, and the sheet of metal makes no change of the antenna pattern, the impedance, nothing changes. Now, once that sheet of metal is there, I can say, hey, I'm going to throw away half the dipole. I've now got the half the dipole to the right and the sheet of metal, and the left-hand side, I've thrown it away. And then I take that whole antenna and I rotate it 90 degrees so that the dipole is aimed straight up, half of the dipole is aimed straight up. You and I call that a ground plane antenna. Ground plane antenna works beautifully when it's got that sheet of metal. And when you and I put that ground plane antenna in our backyard, you'd want to do a really thorough job. You're laying down 32 ground plane radials, a quarter wavelength long. Let me drop. You're trying to duplicate that sheet of metal. Well, if you're willing to build the antenna twice as long, make it a half wavelength long instead of a quarter wavelength long, all of that ground plane radial requirement goes away. The other half of the dipole does exactly what that sheet of metal does, if you know what I mean. There's a lot of advantage in building antennas that are half wave. And once you decide to build an antenna electronically half wave, it can be the same length as a quarter wave antenna, but you put a loading coil in the middle of it to bring it down to the resonant frequency of a half wave. And now you feed it from the bottom, from the outer edge. No ground plane required. You're feeding a many thousand ohm impedance, and just the coax cable itself is a good enough ground plane, a good enough counterpoise, if you know what I mean, when you're feeding that high an impedance. There are people who are afraid to feed the outer end of a dipole because it's an unbalanced way of feeding it. They think they're going to get a whole lot of current flowing down the outside of the dipole, the outside of the coax cable. Let me drop. On paper, that sounds good and logical. If you get into the specifics, you find out it's dead wrong. Assume now I'm feeding the outer tip of a dipole. Because I've shrunk the dipole down in size, it is, let me pick a number, 10,000 ohms of impedance, resistive impedance. That's a simple L network to step it up to feed it. No problem as far as feeding is concerned. But 10,000 ohms of impedance is 200 times higher than 50 ohms. That means the current that flows down the outside of your cable that you're worrying about is 200 times lower than the current flowing down the center of the cable. So even if there was current flowing down the outside of the coax cable because you're doing this unbalanced feeding, it's 200 times lower. It's minuscule. Stop worrying about it. Yeah, it's there. But when it's that small, whether or not you talk about it, it's academic. It'll take you fancy instrumentation to even measuring it. So there's a whole class of antennas that we have been ignoring because it's unconventional, feeding the outer tip of a dipole. If you're at a field day operation, and with your slingshot or bow and arrow, you shoot a piece of wire in the air across a tree that's tall enough, and just the bottom of the wire comes down, and now you force it into electronic resonance as a half wave, and you're feeding it at the bottom between it and a stake in the ground. You don't need a bunch of ground plane radials when you're feeding that high an impedance from the tip of a dipole. On top of that, let me drop. The center of the dipole is where the high current is. You've got this half wavelength long piece of wire with no center insulator. The high current point of the wire is now a quarter wavelength above the ground. The high current point that's doing all the radiating is far away from the earth. Therefore, the amount of coupling it has into that resistive volumetric material that you and I call dirt, it's a quarter wavelength away. It can't couple the energy into the dirt, even though there's no ground plane radial there. You see the advantage you get out of this.
It's unconventional. The books don't tell us about this. But the few guys who have done it have said, why hasn't somebody told me about this before? It's so simple. It's so high in performance. Why isn't it more popular? Because it's a little bit unconventional. Okay. I think I did hear somebody on the input saying they wanted to make a comment or had another question. But because they didn't have the PL tone turned on, they weren't coming through the repeater. Want to give it another try? That other person? K2LIW listening.
I didn't change the PL tone on my radio, so I don't understand why it shouldn't be working today as it was last week.
You sound beautiful today, Joe, W2RYY. So right now you're coming through beautifully, and as I told people, because you didn't get handled the last week or the week before, whenever you appear, you go to the head of the line. Go right ahead if you've got a question. W2RYY, K2RYW, and the Tech Man.
The inputs were turned off, Dick. That's why you didn't hear him.
Oh, sorry about that. Wasn't your fault, Joe. Joe, go right ahead with your question or comment. You were being switched out. You're now switched on.
Interesting with your question.
Step right on top of me. Go ahead. You know what? You can put me on the head of the line for 2 months from now, okay?
You're on the head of the line today. Go right ahead with your question today, Joe. You're number one on the runway right now. Ready for takeoff. You got it, Joe.
Sorry I didn't sign on early. I don't have a question, I have a comment. And this has to do with something you told me how to construct a few weeks ago. I finally got the thing put together and actually had some interesting results about it. And that's putting an RF detector, and I decided to build it into a pill bottle. And I found out something very interesting about a pill bottle, which I never realized before. And that is that the pill bottle, the opaqueness of it, actually will insulate the thing from RF from the outside to the inside, just like it does with light to protect the pills. How about that?
That's good to know. So in other words, I am guessing the pill bottle you used really has the equivalent of silvering, so to speak, a sprayed-on material that's supposed to stop ultraviolet light. I'm guessing the ultraviolet light on a sunny day shining through a pill bottle is capable of creating the greatest amount of aging of your pharmaceutical that's inside. So what you're discovering is that the pill bottle itself is RF shield, RF conductive, as well as the bottle itself is trying to act like a short circuit to the optical and ultraviolet. I think you're saying it's simultaneously a short circuit to the radio. Did you discover that by putting a coil inside and finding out the coil inside the plastic bottle and outside the plastic bottle tunes very, very differently, almost like it's going into a shielded IF can? Is that what you're saying, Joe? Interesting discovery. W2RYY, K2RYW.
No, that's not what I did at all. Nothing. Nothing like that at all. I built the entire detector on a piece of perf board. I put a simple LED, low current LED, like you suggest, a nice red LED, low current. It takes about 1.6 volts and about 1 or 2 mils of current to light the thing up. So it's fairly low current. I use a Schottky diode, number 543. I think it's the exact specs on the thing. And that seemed to work fairly well. The physicality of the coil I used for a pickup coil, I had to experiment with. But basically, when this thing was unassembled out of the pill bottle, I could hold this near my signal generator. And with the signal generator at about 420 megahertz with the antenna right next to this coil, I could get the LED to light up from my signal generator, putting out plus 20 dBm. So I would say the thing was fairly sensitive. When I put something into the pill bottle, I can no longer do that. Now, I also tested it by using my HDN low power at about 0.5 watts at a certain distance away. The distance decreased dramatically as I put the thing inside the pill bottle compared to pulling it outside of the pill bottle. I'd say I lost about 4, 5, or 6 decibels of sensitivity easily going through the plastic of the pill bottle. That's what I use for construction.
Yeah, that's good information, Joe. Using a really sensitive red light-emitting diode with a half-wave dipole and some kind of a simple impedance matching device across it little choke, as I remember. We use that as a detector for RF pickup on our handheld radio frequency identification reader. The reader in my hand was running 1 watt into a 3-element Yagi at the part of the reader in my hand. It's a handheld device made by Symbol Technology. And the dipole itself with that light-emitting diode on it could be as much as 10 feet away in a dark room, and you would see it lighting. 10 feet away from a 1-watt transmitter, we could light that thing up. Go 5 feet away, and it lighted nice and bright. Let me drop.
I didn't have a half-wave dipole inside the pill bottle.
I'm well aware of that. I'm just telling you what the dipole. This is a 915 megacycle dipole, roughly 4.5 inches long, with this little light-emitting diode in the center with a little bit of impedance matching device, and 10 feet away from a 1-watt transmitter, plus 30 dBm, into a 6 dB gain antenna. So we're putting out 4 watts of ERP. What is that? Plus 36 dBm is what we're running, and we could light it up at 10 feet. With your plus 20 dBm, you're lighting it up real close, and you didn't even have a whole halfway dipole on there. I know you had a simple coil. And now when you put that in the pill bottle, it acts as a shielded. But a simple light-emitting diode on a dipole can do a beautiful job of plotting for you an antenna pattern. Can't remember the call letters of the old-timer Greenberg. Greenberg is his name. It's a four generation family of ham radio operators. Art Greenberg used to have, it wasn't a light emitting diode. In his day, he was doing it with a neon bulb. But he had a neon bulb on a dipole like device, and he would walk around during his demonstrations in front of a Yagi like antenna. And you could see the antenna pattern by when the neon bulb would light up, depending on where he is holding it. So, visual devices for measuring an antenna pattern, that's a whole art and science, that's a whole lot of fun. So, I guess you have to choose another brand of pill bottles. I wonder if there's a brand of pill bottles out there. I'd like to believe that somebody builds a pharmaceutical which is not ultraviolet sensitive, therefore they don't have to put it into these exotic bottles. Therefore, a simpler bottle will not act as an RF shield. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I don't know if anybody makes one, actually, W2RY. I don't know. I've never seen a cleaner one or anything resembling other than what they give you with pills in it, which is basically a brownish-colored pipe of plastic. Now, I don't know what the plastic is actually conceived of. If there's something within the plastic itself, or the spray-on coating, I don't know. But I do know it absolutely does stop RF at 420 megahertz from going through it. In fact, even 800 makes a difference, too, because I took the thing to work. You use the 800 meg transmitter, and there's a significant difference when they took the circuit board and energized it with a transmitter and a certain distance away out of the pill bottle compared to being inside the pill bottle. Back to you.
Now, there are glass bottles of roughly the same size you can get your hands on, Joe. So, by way of a glass bottle, the good news is that it doesn't have intentional coatings on there to stop RF or light. The bad news is the glass bottle has got a lot more mass to it. So now the dielectric constant of the glass being nearby your circuit is going to give you a predictable amount of detuning, which in theory you can compensate for. You can retune it inside of a glass bottle. So you may have to go to a glass bottle. I presume you want to put it inside of a pillbox or bottle for reasons of protection. I think this is a poor man's radome that you're creating. Is that roughly it, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, it is, because on the back cap of this thing, I took a 10K potentiometer and put it on the ground side of the LED. On the hot side, I put a much smaller resistor, just to limit the current when the pot was turned up all the way. And the idea was, if I held it very close to a high-power transmitter, I wanted to have controllability as far as the current going to the LED. So if I got into a very, very close, very high-level RF field, I could turn the thing down. That actually works very well by itself, but the sensitivity within itself does change going from this inside this plastic bottle. I'll have to ask around and find out if any of these local places sell these bottles that are not of this brownish color. See if I could buy one from him. I'm sure that'll cost a lot of money. It was very simple to be able to drill a hole in the end of the bottle to put the LED through, and the other end of the cap, just simply drill a hole out to put the potentiometer. Very simple to make the thing, and then made the perf board to fit inside the thing. To do it. Very simple amount of just wiring parts and so forth. But the pill bottle threw me as far as having the thing sealed, the thing marked. I didn't expect that to happen, but you learn something new every day, don't you, Dick?
Yeah. John recognized. I know that Wes wants to ask a question. Maybe John's got something else he wants to tell me. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
I try a small plastic baby bottle. They come in very small sizes.
Give us that whole story again, then. Small plastic baby bottle. N2MB, go ahead.
You can pick them up in any store. It's, you know, for a milk, for a baby. But you can get those bottles pretty small for a small baby, you know. You can get them in 3 ounces, you can get them in 6 ounces, and they even come, you don't have to have the nipple. You take the nipple off and have a little plastic thing that you put in there instead of the nipple. So I think that might solve his problem.
Yeah, but one thing with that, what I was thinking of also, I was trying to avoid the problem with safety if you drop this thing. That's why I made it out of something like a pill bottle. It's plastic. You drop on the floor, nothing's going to happen. It's not going to break, shatter, or injure somebody. That's why I went in that direction to begin with. So I think I'm going to stick with something of a plastic bottle design and try to find something that's of a different type of construction, different opaqueness or clearness of the bottle, and maybe that might be better for me. I think I want to stay away from glass.
I haven't seen a glass baby bottle in years, so they're all plastic today.
Aren't the mothers worried about the chemistry that's leaching out of the plastic still? Or are they not worried about that, Barry? Go ahead.
No, I think they're making them out of plastics that don't have chemicals that leach out of them. And I think he's going to be okay with that.
Beautiful. John, KC2WGB, go ahead with your comment or whatever.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick. A quick answer to that is, if you go into Home Depot and go in the section where nails and brads are sold, you can get exactly what you need. There's a couple of screws in it or a couple of brads, and it has a nice pop-on cap. I've built a lot of interesting stuff in that type of container, and they're dirt cheap, so that'll take you out of trouble.
Oh, so Home Depot's got it when I'm buying screws and brads and so on. Yes, yes, I remember seeing those bottles. Sometimes they're in bubble packs, too, as far as the bottle itself. Here we go. Wes, I know you had a question on some of the previous. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, I have a question of my own, if you don't mind.
I think you're changing subjects, and that's not allowed yet. John, I know we've delayed quite a bit on the mailbagging. We're probably keeping those kids up late. Although, wait a minute now. This is the weekend where they can allow to stay up late. KC2WG, go ahead with the mailbag. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very well. I've got a quick couple of construction questions, and then we can get on to Paul in the mailbag. I know you have to leave, so these two should not be difficult. Have a gentleman who's talking about phased array harness. Okay, he's making up two cables out of LMR 400. He's got two antenna systems, it's going to be four Yagis. They're different frequencies. He's got one set for the 400 band and one for the 2 meter band. So now, he's asking, how critical do you have to be to get the exact length? He's having a problem getting the length right now. What would be acceptable in fractions of an inch, would you say, at, say, 2 meters and then at 440?
Yeah, in the past, I did study this problem. It's very similar to a hybrid combining of two transmitters. If I've got two amplifiers and I'm being combined the power between the two, how accurate do I have to figure out the phase delay of my summing device where I'm putting the two together and the cables going into it? How fast does the power go down as I get it out of phase? and assuming you're using a thoroughly impedance-matched device, like a hybrid, which means that any power that is not properly matched goes into a terminating resistor. In the case of an antenna, if you're receiving a signal with two antennas and you're combining them into a power summer, a power divider being used backwards, the energy that is not properly matched, because most of the kinds of power summers that we build as ham radio operators do not contain a terminating resistor inside. Let me go. Therefore, we've got what happens to the mismatched power, and the answer, it gets re-radiated back into space. So the space is a 50-ohm resistor, if you know what I mean. Therefore, the two chunks of power add in a voltage manner, and they add as a cosine theta. In other words, if there was 10 degrees of error between the two, one cable is longer by the other by 10 degrees, which is 1/36th of a wavelength, 360 degrees divided by 10, if you know what I mean. You end up with a cosine of 10 degrees, happens to be 0.99 something. So, and then that's voltage, and you take the log of that and multiply it by 20, and now you know exactly how much power you lose in the real dBm. So if you're within 10 degrees, usually that's more than good enough. If you were 20 degrees wrong, it's not a disaster. By the time you start getting 30 degrees wrong, which is what, approaching a tenth of a wavelength, if I get that right, yeah, in that order, you're starting to see some power fall off. There are people who think that when you're summing power from amplifiers, antennas, or whatever, that everything's got to be the nearest fraction of a degree. That's much too severe a requirement. 10 degrees is more than good enough. At 432, where the wavelength is 27 inches long, 10 degrees is probably around an inch in that vicinity. If at 432 or at 450, you've got only an inch of error on your various cables, you're within 98% or so of the power summing that's going to work out correctly. Mathematically, there's not too much magic to this. Bear in mind now that whenever you're summing multiple signals, Mother Nature does not think in power. She thinks in voltage. It's never made clear in any of the courses I've taken. Take your voltage of signal number one, your voltage of signal number two, and add them together. And the cosine theta of the angle of...
Repeater, timeout.
The angle of error between the two. You take the cosine of that angle, and then sum them together. You're doing vector summing, if you know what I mean. The voltages coming from your two antennas, or your two amplifiers, really are vector voltage signals. And so you add them in a vector manner by the normal rules of vector, and you know exactly what you're going to get. So the bottom line is 10 degrees. An inch of error on 440 is more than tolerable. You can probably tolerate a full 3 inches of error on 2 meters at least. I wonder if that's some of the answer you're looking for, John. I've been there. KC2WGB, K2RAW. Let's see what Eric's got to say in this one. You got it, Eric.
Hi, two things. One, when I build a power summer, I generally use 100 ohm resistor. So, that takes care of that. But the other thing is that at 512 megahertz, the transmitter is that. And if you remember the big behemoth that had multiple cabinets, because of the variables and unknowns, I always use a trombone. And you do get a little bit of latitude, but there is definitely a point where you get the maximum sum when they're precisely equal in length. So that way, assuming, of course, that you're generating your RF exactly in phase coming out of both transmitters, with the trombone, you can get very precise. And I found that, you know, at 500 megahertz, it's kind of like a half an inch. It's really where you want to be. And there, it doesn't make much difference, but you can move the trombone and get it precisely at maximum when you get the total sum of the voltage. I just wanted to throw that in there. K2RWK2K.
Your requirement, Eric, is a little bit more severe than the average amateur radio requirement. You're working with, in many cases, multiple kilowatt transmitters, and any mismatch that you have that's going into your 100-ohm resistor And you said 100 ohm resistor, which sounds like it is a Wilkinson hybrid that's doing your power summing. Most quadrature hybrids operate with a 50 ohm termination. So 100 ohm termination, Wilkinson hybrid, and now when you've got kilowatts of power being summed, and you'd rather not be putting a 500 watts of it, so to speak, into that terminating resistor. So your requirement is a lot more severe. The average amateur, if he lost half a dB because he had less than ideal summing, rarely would we know the difference, if you know what I mean. And so you think it's half an inch, I think it's an inch. That's the ballpark, as you can tell. And so there are ways you can make it perfect. If you really want to be exact, you worry about the fact that the roll of cable that you're using, is it all being cut from the exact same roll? Two consecutive rolls of foam-filled cable can have two different velocity factors. So unless you're measuring it on a vector network analyzer, you might not find that. And if all the cable is coming from the same roll, you're pretty safe with one exception. Let me drop. Even when it all comes from the same roll, a foam-filled cable, near the beginning of the roll and near the end of the roll, the machine is rolling at a slightly different rate. Therefore, the foam density at the end of the roll is different. Therefore, in the old days, you used to be able to buy 70-ohm hardline CATV cable, and you could buy very inexpensively what's called the mill ends. They knew that the end of the roll had different characteristics. Therefore, they would sell it separately at a cut rate price because the mill end had a different velocity factor. Something to know about. It's rare that we run into it, but occasionally it happens. KC2WTB. I'll be leaving you in 2 minutes. K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. Well, we'll get thanks for that information. He's worried about like 16th of an inch and 32nd of an inch in these 2 6-foot-long cables. So I'm sure he's very happy to hear what Eric and you had to say about that. Okay, Dick, let's go to Paul, and I've got these. I'll put on the side for next week. No problem with that. Let's get the Paul space report started, and enjoy your trip. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, bye-bye, you all. And Paul, you got the floor. WS2N. What is NASA doing these days? K2RIW. I'll be listening to what you say as I drive, but I won't be able to talk back to you. You got it, Paul.
Very good, 73, Dick. All right, email it. Any comments then to space net report at gmail.com, and we'll continue it that way too, Dick. Then we'll pile on more information for next week. A couple of items, Dick. The European Space Agency Rosetta mission, and I've talked about it a lot. That's the one that was following a comet for quite a few months. Was launched 10 years ago to do this, and now it's in orbit around 67P. Now they've just finalized five different possible landing spots on this comet. And they're going to do this in November. So they have the Rosetta spacecraft. It has a lander on board. Philip is going to separate from Rosetta and go down and land on this comet. It's got some cables on board. It's going to shoot a couple of spikes into the comet. It's going to pull itself down, and then on the landing legs, it's got these screw type of things that are going to screw itself into the comet to try to hold it from drifting off because of the low gravity. That's one topic. The second topic I wanted to bring up was the launch of Soyuz spacecraft. Soyuz rocket from French Guiana. The European Space Agency normally uses Ariane 5 rockets to put spacecraft into either orbit or into planetary or even to the L2 position. They've done that with Herschel, and they're going to be doing that with the James Webb Space Telescope using the Ariane 5. But they use other rockets, too. They have a new one for lower payload weights, something called Vega.